Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, Lee Cantor here with Mr. Stone Payton for another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. How you doing, Stone?
Good morning, sir. I am doing well. I'm looking forward to a little bit. Is it early this afternoon? We're going to go out and we're going to visit that agency that we had in here the other day?
That's right. I love to visit advertising agencies. They're very creative. You never know what to expect when you head over there.
We could play some Nerf basketball, ride a skateboard.
They always have foosball or some game that you're good at that you mastered in college.
Maybe they have ping pong or
exactly.
A Segway.
You think they have a Segway? I'd hire him just for that.
Absolutely.
But today is an exciting show because it's another episode where we get to spotlight the Georgia Society of CPAs. And you know they are a fun group.
They are. So we have with us this morning from the Georgia Society of CPAs, Carly Buchanan, John Masters, and Joel Pascanner. And, you know, I'd like to jump right in and start with you, Joel. Give us a little bit of a feel, if you would, just mission and purpose of Georgia Society of CPAs. What's that all about?
The Georgia Society of CPAs is a professional organization. We have thousands of members. And the main purpose, or at least the main purpose of our section, is to educate and disseminate information to accountants throughout the state in various areas, in various disciplines, particularly in our particular aspect with respect to taxation. We sponsor numerous events throughout the year. There are various chapters throughout the state, and it is certainly one of the larger state societies in the country.
And so you guys play well together, Carly?
We try to play well together.
But, no, I mean, you guys compete at some level, don't you?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah? We sure do. Yeah. I mean, but I think us as a whole, as a community, we want to be able to benefit and encourage our members to, you know, pool their resources. And anytime you get a group of professionals together that want to improve the quality of anything in taxation, we want to be better. So
how do you get good at taxation?
Years of experience.
practice.
Lots of reading laws.
But don't the laws change all the time?
They do. So you kind of have to have the personality that you like to continuously learn.
Uh-huh.
You have to be able to read and know how to interpret everything. And I think if I was doing the same thing over and over again, I would go crazy. So,
but if I have a problem and I went to five different CPAs that are experts in taxation, could I possibly get five different answers?
You possibly could, depending on the person, too. I mean, I know with myself, I have people that are more risk takers than others.
Right.
And I can say, this is your risk. So some people are like, nope, I am by the book. I want to be very conservative. And there's other people that are like, you know what? It doesn't really say I can't do that. Let's try it, and I'll take the risk. So it depends.
You know, there is that example, and you see it almost every year, where they give a tax problem, and they do give it to 5 or 10 different CPAs. And, of course, the irony is you come back, as you were just suggesting, with 10 different results.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of gray areas, as you know, and we're going to talk about some of them today.
John Masters, you're part of this outfit as well. How long have you been involved with the Georgia Society of CPAs?
I don't really remember, to tell you the truth.
That's a long time.
He doesn't want to tell.
Or it's not a long time.
It's been a long time, several years.
And all three of you are in this taxation segment?
We are members of, there is a tax section that is part of the Georgia Society of CPAs.
Right.
We are members of the leadership team of that particular tax section. It's made up of maybe 12 to 15 people, and we meet monthly, stay on top of things, and sort of get involved in education and dissemination of information.
Open bar.
Yeah.
All the time. and do
things like this.
Yeah, just like this. And we're three members from that group.
So now it's 2013 now. Is there any interesting changes in the tax laws since, in this year as opposed to previous years?
Well,
what's your, number one thing that you're kind of warning your clients about?
Well, when you say the 2013 year, we have, there's two different things you can look at. 2013 is you're actually filing your taxes for 2012.
Right.
So some of the changes that have happened from 2011 to 2012, we always, accountants live in a prior
right,
year,
yeah.
So I say prior year is 2011. A lot of it has to do just with inflation.
Uh-huh.
Deduction levels have gone up. as far as your what they call a standard deduction. Also, personal exemptions have gone up. But a lot of the thresholds, like if you hear I'm in the 25% bracket, I'm in the 10% bracket, those have all been increased a little bit for inflation. Example would be if you're a married couple, if you made $69,000 or below, you were taxed at 15%. Well, now in 2012, it's $70,700. Then you kick up into the next bracket. So a lot of those things have been ratcheted up a little bit.
Credits, so all that's good for an individual, right?
It is.
Those are smiley face changes.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. 2013 might have a little bit more, but credits have gone up. If people have heard of the earned income credit, that's where if it's a benefit for people that are low to moderate income levels, and that's also increased $140. So your max credit last year was around $5,700, and this year it's $5,800, almost $5,900 that you can get. And you get the max credit when you have a large family, three or more kids,
right,
and you're married. Other things, earned income or the lifetime learning credit, that's if you have kids that are in college, that there's thresholds. If you make too much money, you can't take that credit. Well, they've raised that up. It's now at $104,000, so that's good too.
Right.
And also student loan interest, if you have kids in school that you're paying qualified interest on, again, if you make too much money, you can't take that deduction, and they've raised that $5,000. So instead of it being, you know, $150,000, you can't take it at all. Now it's $155,000, so that's a good thing.
Good stuff.
So are there any frowny face changes too that you can think
2012,
of?
2012, not so much. 2013,
we've got
some.
That's where things are going to hit the fan.
Yeah, John can cover a little bit more on that. So.
John, you're the Grim Reaper. Tell us about the frowny face changes.
The Grim Reaper. Well, there are some changes in 2013, which we won't talk too much about those, but some of them are called Medicare tax, but it's really just the increase in income tax of 0.9%. There's an increase taxes on passive income, dividends, interest, and so on, of 3.8%, which is part of the Health Care Act. And there are other miscellaneous changes that will come into effect, but really we still don't know what the tax rule is going to be for 2013. So
really?
Well, it's only February, so...
So that's okay to not know?
That's a little scary.
At what point do you start caring that you don't know?
Well, January 1st next year.
Yeah, you can't really. Hopefully. This year, January the 1st wasn't quite good enough. Mm-hmm. So
continually issue regulations and interpretations, and it takes sometimes months. And you're right, we might not even know by January, but the framework we have, and that framework John was talking about, in addition, of course, the increase this additional higher tax bracket we've got for 13. Used to be 35%, and frowny face is 39.6. So,
Speaking of thresholds, give me your best feel for this. Old man with broken dreams like me that just makes a modest living. What is the threshold for whether or not I should engage a professional CPA? I mean, somebody with Lee's pockets, you know, people like that, they need to have a team of CPAs probably.
Right.
But, I mean, at what point in your income or in your situation do you say, look, I got to have some professional help here?
Well, actually, I think you need more help at the lower end than you do the upper end, because things are so complicated that when you make a lot of money, well, you're going to pay some tax probably. I mean, there are things you can do, but it's incredibly complicated when you look at such simple things as what is a dependency exemption. Sounds like a very easy question. Very difficult sometimes to figure out who's entitled to the dependency exemptions and so forth. So the definitional framework is a lot. And with the child credit, education credits, a lot of these things have thresholds, and Carly said, if you make too much money, well, now there really isn't such a thing.
Right.
That's not what she meant. What she really meant was if you make enough money, then you don't qualify. And the thresholds are fairly low. When I became an accountant back before they invented calendars, the you know, $100,000 a year was a pretty magnificent income.
Right.
Today, however, it's not what it used to be. And even fairly recently, they talked about wealthy was $150,000 a year income. Inflation, even though they say there is no inflation, just look at, if you keep copies of your old tax returns, look back 10 or 15 years and
right.
ask yourself whether there's inflation or not. There truly is. Anyway, the complications are there for the low, what I would say the lower income, you know, under 50,000, under 100,000. It's very complex. So you could use an account at any time.
Just your working class stiff still needs an accountant.
Absolutely.
That's what I think I'm hearing you guys say.
Unfortunately, that, I believe, is what Congress has done to us.
Now, what do you guys think about all those, like I know, I don't want to name, oh, I'll name them, H&R Block, like the ads for them and the competitors of them, and then all these online kind of do-it-yourself things. How do, like, professional CPAs feel about, you know, companies like that? Is that good for your business or bad for it? I mean, on one hand, it's educating consumers that may or not have used the CPA in the past, but saying that there's a need for that. So what's your guys' take on that?
I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's a fact of life, and they certainly provide a very useful service. And for many people, it is it's a good route to go. I would generally tend to say that you're probably better off with someone else, maybe someone from, you know, affiliated with a professional society.
Right.
They do a good job. They do mass quantities, and certainly the type of people they do is, I'd say, generally speaking, is maybe just limited to a certain type of strata as being overly
But John
general.
Was saying that the lower income people are the ones that might benefit the most from having a professional.
I don't know if they benefit the most, but they certainly can benefit tremendously.
Right.
I think the problems that exist with the higher net worth and the lower net worth, that there's certainly some of the problems are one and the same. And there are problems that are characteristic of lower net wealth people or middle income people
right.
that are highly challenging. But I would say, you know, we frequently do work that those firms have, you know, worked on in the past. I think we do a little bit better quality. Maybe I'm being a little
So you guys fix, you know, those online tax returns? That's what you do.
Well,
yes,
that's their slogan.
Is that what you do? I mean, I would imagine that that's part. I mean, we had a plastic surgeon in here that said, like, I fixed, you know, $3,000 nose jobs or something, you know?
Yeah, they're all wrong. We fix them all.
But there's technology has changed the entire industry. And as Congress makes things more complicated, then it becomes a programmer's issue. You got to. Mm-hmm. You got a program, and you can automate a lot of things. So, I remember when the tax returns were first prepared by computers. You know, that was really kind of a far out thing. Well, it's not a far out thing today.
Right.
Everybody can do that, and so to a large extent, CPAs spend more time figuring out to do things that you can't just automate.
Right.
So some of the things that are very common but are lower income brackets, maybe they're more easily automated. So, and H&R Block and other companies like that provide a big service because they can do those things that might not be practical for us to do because they're using a different skill set and a different educational level to a large extent
I always try to say that if they've got something unusual, something more than just a house and some kids. I mean, those are pretty good, easy questions that they can
right.
ask. Do you have children? Do you make this amount of money?
Right.
And those things are programmable. But when
right.
it's, do you have a rental property? Do you have
or
your
stocks
own business
or
something that's unusual? You want somebody that's going to ask the right questions instead of just ask what's on the screen.
Right.
And we want to be sure and keep Congress up there making things complicated so
well,
they can keep
good.
Us in
that's
business.
Right. That's good
say.
Job security for you, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, we got to keep those guys.
So you guys are not for the flat tax?
Oh, no.
God, no.
Can't have that.
God, no.
But you all three of you got to love that that commercial campaign where the person's fixing the sink or selling them clothes at the Gap or something. Like, don't
no.
I know you? Didn't you do my taxes?
You're right. No, I think our security has sort of been insured with these new changes for quite some time. But
you got job security for a while.
I think so. I think so.
And Joel, I mean, he had mentioned before that they do studies every year where they send the same person with the same facts into each one of these places, like the places you see in the strip mall that just open up and they have a guy sitting at the table.
Right, all of a sudden there's like...
And then there's the H&R Blocks and the, you know, and they go send them to each, and what were your refunds, and what did it cost, and the comparison.
And it could be dramatically different from place to place.
Yeah, totally. And of course, sometimes just incorrectly, they'll see maybe the H&R Block guy, no knock to them, comes up with the highest refund, and it's a nice marketing tool. That's the guy we're going to.
Right.
Well, one thing I would point out is there are scam artists out there. Identity theft is a big issue these days, and so it is important for people to pay attention that they actually go to somebody, whether it's a commercial preparer or a CPA, that they go to somebody that they do believe is okay.
And that's why the society is so important, because it's a place where the professionals hang out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, now it's time for on the show where we ask you specific tax questions to see how on top of your game you are.
Awesome.
You got your buzzer? Does everybody have a buzzer?
I'm going to win. I'm going to bring it.
All right. Here's question number one. If my dependent child is a full-time college student, can he or she claim themselves as a dependent on his or her tax return? Tick tock.
Oh, okay.
Anybody up
that's
for that?
A question. All right. I feel like I'm on Jeopardy. I'm going to actually answer this
question.
You
guys.
Okay. I'll field this one.
You got this one?
I think so. This can be a little tricky, but I'm going to try to keep it simple. If you have a child who is a full-time student and is under the age of 24, normally that child you would take a dependency exemption for. I believe the dependency exemption amount for 20, because we're talking about 2012 right now, is $3,800. And that would enable you to take this exemption, and you would get a tax benefit for that. The other part of this question, I guess, is that child is a full-time student, goes to college, and I think Carly, John, maybe myself, we did touch on these tuition-related credits, benefits, that have various thresholds. And that's part of the issue with all of these things. You got various different thresholds for all different laws, and they sort of come into play, and then they sort of phase out. It's very difficult to keep track of them. But it is likely that the parent could get a dependency deduction but not get the benefit of a tuition credit. So something that you could consider doing, if you have a higher income parent whose income is so high that it would result in the phase out of these credits, the parent could waive this dependency exemption and allow the student dependent to claim the educational credit. But you got to kind of do a little bit of analysis.
So this takes planning. Like, this isn't something I can just hand you these documents and you go do these 12 things. I mean, I got to be working with you throughout the year, it seems. It's going to be very difficult for me to give you my shoebox full of receipts and then say, here, what do I owe? And
yeah, the shoebox. I would get away from the shoebox anyway. That's a whole different question. Okay, but we'll give the shoebox in periodically instead of once a year. But, yeah, this is the kind of thing where we can look at this at the end of the year and say...
Well, you would know. If you were working with me for a while, you would know my kid's in college and you'd know that this is coming up, or you'd know what my income is, so you'd be able to counsel me, right?
Correct.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We could tell you, hey, you're better off not taking, even though you could take it, don't take the dependency exemption. It's better for your kid. He happened to work at... I know your kid worked at 4 or 5 jobs.
Exactly.
And maybe it was 8 or 10. I don't remember, but... worked at a lot of jobs, and your kid might be able to get that credit. Maybe it's $2,000, $2,500. You can't get it.
Right.
It's better off for him to take it. He's got his own tax return to file.
All right. See that? You learned something.
See? Judges? Thumbs up on that.
Answer. All right.
All right. So
thumbs
I get
up.
I get
you get
to do
the next question.
Okay.
1 point to Joel.
Okay.
I sold my house in year 2012 for a gain.
Yep.
What are the rules?
Well, that's like a miracle, right?
Right.
First of all, congratulations.
Not as big of a miracle as it would have been a couple of years ago.
We're talking fantasy land here. So what
are the rules with respect to gain on the sale of a residence? How's the gain calculated? And what if I'd have taken a loss?
Well, I'll field that one. All right.
Go for it.
The exclusion for a single person is $250,000 of gain. So that would be great to have $250,000 of gain on a house. Now, if you're married, it's double, so it's $500,000. And in order to even to qualify for that, you have to have lived in the home for a minimum of 2 years. The 2 years don't have to be consecutive. So say you lived in it and then you rented it and then you lived in it again. It has to be at least 24 months in the previous five-year period. And generally, you can only claim it every 2 years. So you can't claim it 1 year and have multiple properties and say, you know, I lived in this one over 2 years this year and this other house and take the exclusion.
I haven't seen one of those lately.
No, I haven't. Yeah. But exceptions do apply. There's three exceptions.
Of course they do.
Exceptions are great. That's what we live by, is exceptions.
Exactly. There are a lot of good exceptions.
And then exceptions to exceptions, of course.
The first exception is job change. So if you have changed your work, again, there's more details. It's not just as easy as you've changed your job. It has to be so many miles and things and more details. So that's something you'd want to talk about. Or if your employer has required, we need you to go to this office that's across country. Can you move? Health concerns. That's the second big one, is if you have medical bills and things, you have to document. So make sure that you keep a physician's record of of your health issues that you either have to move. Say something happened and you needed a house that's all on one level. So just make sure you keep that. Doesn't have to be sent in with your tax return, but you just need to keep it in a file so if they ever come back. And then unforeseen circumstances. And they actually give you a definition of what unforeseen circumstances are.
Is that defined now?
It is.
Everything is defined, yes.
What's unforeseen?
Write these
down. Not foreseen. How can you define it?
It's an occurrence of an event that could not reasonably be anticipated before buying and occupying your main home. And examples are natural disasters, acts of war, terrorism, change in employment or unemployment that left you unable to pay for your basic living needs, death, divorce,
so separation. Losing your job is an unforeseen?
It is.
Really?
Yes.
And that's interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It is kind of unforeseen. And then members of the foreign service or in the, I'm sorry, uniform services or foreign service and intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. Those as well, they have a test that you can actually elect to defer. So if you're deployed or you're out of the country, you know, there's some tests that they have to, but they can elect to defer that five-year period test for up to 10 years. So if the exclusion, now if you qualify as the exclusion, you only get part, if you've lived, so an example would be if you lived in your house for 12 months and you had health concerns. So your employer, or say you're married and you have to divide it. So 12 months is half of the two-year period, so right. You get half of the $250,000 exclusion. It's just part, but it's...
There are lots of exceptions, so anytime you've got a question about that, it's good to look into the exceptions. The regulations there are fairly liberal, and a lot of times you'll find, well, okay, I can do better than I thought I could to start with.
But this is all stuff where you and your CPA are working this out, and then, like you were saying, Carly, that I'm deciding as the client how much risk I'm willing to take. Like if I believe this gray area is, I'm deciding if it's gray or not, right? You're presenting me with options, and then I'm saying, you know what, I'll go for that deduction or I'll go for that treatment of the tax law.
Well, we're not really talking about gray. We're just talking about there are a lot of weird kind of situations that develop, and if you look, you find out, well, there's a regulation that they've already looked at that and said that's okay, but you might not, you wouldn't know that necessarily.
Right.
So you have to check these things out.
And when you say check them out, where are you going? You're calling somebody up at the government and saying, hey.
Yeah, I got my buddy up there. Like, hey, Joe.
Right. Hey, government
this.
Guy.
Come on, tell me. Yeah. Now, you have to look. There are thousands of pages of rules, regulations,
and tax
law.
Can you, like, call the IRS and say, look, how are you going to treat this?
You can get any answer you want.
And then, but they won't.
It's generally going to be pro-government. That's always
right.
The assumption. And
you're usually
going to
get the answer you don't want
right.
from them.
Well,
you're calling right. them up because they're going to take the safe route.
You want to do some research. I mean, you want to look for the regulations.
So you're looking at the regulations, but you're not calling somebody at the IRS to get clarification.
No.
You would never do that? That's ridiculous?
It's not ridiculous, but they do studies on that, too, and their accuracy rate is probably...
H&R Block level.
Well, it varies.
It
but
varies.
It's
right.
not something that I would want to depend on.
And you can't say, like, oh, the guy said it was this, so therefore I did it, so you can't ding me later for that?
Well, if they do it in writing,
Which they probably never do, right?
Well, the instructions are in writing. So there are instructions out there for a lot of things. So if you can check the instructions, you can call somebody that you believe would have the right answer. And a lot of times they may, I would say, I have to look that up. I don't know.
Right.
It's a fact.
A lot of times, too, if there's court cases that have some of the same facts,
right,
but some of them are different, and you can go to your client and say, listen, this is what this says, but this is your case.
It's close, but it's not exact.
Exactly.
Right. And don't forget, we've also had lots of experience with IRS,
right,
other taxing jurisdictions, so that's worth a lot. I mean, as an example,
sure,
say just hypothetically, one of us has a house, we want to sell it, and we're going to recognize a loss, not unusual. If you have your house, if your house is rented or made available for rent, that, generally speaking, loss is not deductible. If it's available for rent or rented, you can deduct the loss. So I might want to say to you, you said, hey, you know, I got a huge loss. I got killed. What am I going to do? I want to take my loss. I say, well, was it rented? You're going to say,
no.
No. And we say, was it made available for
maybe
rent?
Maybe we should make it available for rent.
You're going to say, well, I'll say, maybe you did make it available for rent, or maybe it.
Maybe right now, today, when we get off the phone, I'll make it available.
Maybe there's an ad in the paper that, look, here's an ad, and it says your house. So I'm you know,
right,
exaggerating, but based on experience and court cases and regulations.
But that's a value that the CPA brings. Mm-hmm. Like,
absolutely.
I'm never going to know that.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Right.
So a little earlier in the conversation, we joked a little bit about the shoebox. But is there some wisdom in at least like an electronic kind of shoebox? Help me help my CPA. Should I keep a spreadsheet or something that kind of at least gives you all the data in
like
one nice place?
Is QuickBooks good for you guys?
Hand you that as a starting place?
I love
place?
Some QuickBooks. I love
you like that?
Sometimes sure. Clients do more damage by trying to help than just
right.
giving you the data to start with. Sometimes mm-hmm. just the raw data is the best thing to work with.
Right, or a combination of QuickBooks and the data.
Well, yeah, and when I say the best, time is money. So what you want to do is do whatever takes the least amount of time. Help your accountant the way that you can help him. But
right.
Sometimes people overwork it a lot, and overworking something doesn't actually turn out taking less time. So sometimes the raw data is best. QuickBooks is raw data. QuickBooks
right.
is a good tool, very
but
good tool.
But it's very much garbage in, garbage out. So you should
right.
work
right.
with your accountant, like when you're setting up QuickBooks.
Right, to make sure that you're
what
classifying.
What categories
right.
do you put
right.
it in? Take the right. time up front so that when you get it to the accountant, they're not spending the time cleaning it up.
Right.
You're doing it from the beginning.
Right.
Now, that miscellaneous account has got $69,000 in
it. That's the largest one. That's a problem, probably. Now, what about this alternative minimum tax? You hear a lot of that in the news that, you know, that's a problem for some people. They've been kicking this can down the road for many years. Where are we at in that?
Well, AMT, you know, years ago it was set up just for the highest tax bracket of
right, and then
individuals.
As you've mentioned, that goalpost has moved a little bit.
Well, it's moved. I think initially there was only like 200 people, mm-hmm. something like that.
That
affected.
That even hit. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really cool when they first did it. You know, I thought this is a way to sneak in just a flat tax.
Right.
You know, because inflation will take us all up there. Well, I gave them too much credit. That's not what happened.
And, it's the law of unintended consequences.
And now, I don't know, it's in the millions. You know,
millions of people?
Tons of revenue raised from
it. Yeah, used to. We never even considered it because, you know, I didn't have one of the Kennedys as a client.
Right.
But now, you know, everybody, you have to look at it. Every single taxpayer.
Mm-hmm. You know, originally it was for like that. Somebody in the 60s or 70s who had a very, very rich guy, zero tax.
Right.
And you and I were paying $20,000-$30,000 in tax, so they, I think it was rather simplified then.
It
we
was.
Created this thing. We're going to add back certain tax shelter items, depletion, depreciation, and you're going to pay some tax. Now it has gotten completely out of hand
mm-hmm.
and evolved to an incredible tax regime.
We came up with a solution to that problem.
And what is that?
Make it illegal for any congressman to get anyone to help them with their taxes.
Our congressmen aren't CPAs, right? They're all lawyers. Is that the problem?
Well, there are some CPAs.
A few.
A couple.
Not enough.
Well, so just the AMT, a lot of people that hit it, one of the main reasons is just your itemized deductions. You know, when mm-hmm. you pay your state taxes or medical expenses, miscellaneous expenses, those, you know, it's a completely different set of calculations. It's two parallel tax systems, and you calculate your tax under regular and you calculate your tax under AMT, and you got to pay
the most.
The most, whichever calculates
comes out
higher.
Better, bigger number.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're paying mortgage interest, who doesn't pay mortgage interest?
Right.
And that's part of that calculation. Joel said depreciation. Passive activity bonds, that's a little bit, it's basically an exempt bond issued by the government, and it's usually to build stadiums. Why, you know, they decided that's going to be in there. I mean, you know.
A different program.
Yeah.
It's almost like special interests get kind of some preferential treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Passive income. If you've got rental activities, that's passive income. Mm-hmm. And it, like investment expenses, a lot of people, if they're buying and selling stocks on their own, they're paying investment expenses, and those have something to do. And ways to avoid AMT, you want to lower your income every year. The lower the income, you'll pay regular tax, not the AMT tax rate.
Told you I knew what I was doing.
You were right.
I had a plan.
That are the best tax planning strategy. The way to pay no tax, don't make any money.
You're good.
You could alternatively go the other way. That would be, I don't know if that came to your mind, but if you increase and generate tons of ordinary income, that would also
help.
I'm just sort of giving you an alternative strategy. sort of a flip side, yeah.
But common ways that you reduce income, retirement plans. Give 401k if you've got an employer, or if you're a self-employed, starting a SEP plan. you can sign up if your employer offers medical savings accounts or dependent care, dependent children, and that takes it off the top line, so you're not going to pay tax on that money.
So the more stuff you can take off the top line,
that lowers them. And also you can try to play with when you pay things. An example would be like if you have real estate taxes that are due in January,
right?
Well, maybe in a year where your income's higher or lower, you pay it either in December or
like
January.
December 31st.
Yep, exactly.
That counts as the previous year.
Mm-hmm. So it's you can try to play with either your state. If people are paying quarterly taxes instead of through your employer,
right?
You can pay that as well, either in December or January, and kind of play with that. But if you are in AMT and you're taking the standard deduction, so you know you can either take a standard deduction or itemize.
Mm-hmm.
AMT does not allow the standard deduction. So sometimes even if your standard deduction, you usually want to take the higher of the two numbers, because it's deductions. You want higher deductions. But if you're an AMT, you might want to look at that. And again, work with your accountant to see, well, maybe I shouldn't take the standard deduction and use the itemized, even if it's lower, because in the end, I'm paying a less tax dollar.
Right. So your accountant will give you scenarios, and you can just choose the most beneficial.
Well, one thing, though, is you can overplan or overplan for taxes. And if you do that, for example, with homeowner interest, well, you can wind up where you got a great deduction on the regular way, but you hit with the AMT because it's not deductible for AMT purposes.
Right.
That kind of thing. So you have to be careful with your tax planning and be sure you're thinking about the AMT when you're doing it, or else you may wind up making a mistake after all.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some that happen with people that have taken like a home equity loan to pay down credit card debt.
Sure.
So it just the way the numbers play, it might be better overall because you're the money out of your pocket for paying the less interest. But you kind of got to look at that.
Right.
So. You know, as you were saying, it's kind of thing you got to deal with your tax accountant. Because
it sounds like an ongoing thing. It's not like you just show up once a year and say, here, what am I at? And then they give you a number, and then you go and never talk to them again.
And it's the kind of thing you can't say, am I going to be an AMT or not?
Right.
You got to be like a year ahead.
Like you're saying you're working a year behind, but the client really has to be a year ahead almost.
Mm-hmm. And now, you shouldn't be afraid to ask your CPA, like, hey, what are ways that I can save some money this year and have them think about it. And a lot of times CPAs get caught up during the busy time. So calling them in June and say, hey, what are ways that
there
I can,
go.
It's going to really, they'll have time for you and say, yeah, let's
and you
look
have
at this.
Room to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've seen, I saw, what's that French actor moved to Russia to save taxes and then I've seen some people here in this country, like leave California. Are you seeing that? Is there, the taxes, the state taxes are getting to be high where people are actually moving or people making decisions based on things like that, state
people
income tax?
People love Florida. Oh, absolutely.
Well,
I think we need to be thinking about immigration spelled beginning with an E instead of an I sometimes.
Those are real issues, right, for some people?
Huge issues. I mean, the foreign issue is a big one, and I think the administration and future administrations are very concerned about it, and I think they will act in a manner as to preclude that. The state issue is one that's always been around and is extremely popular, as Carly was saying, Florida, Nevada, states without income tax.
So Florida has no state income tax. Georgia has a state income tax, right?
Right. So you may, tomorrow, you may decide that, or after this show, you may decide that never come back.
So, but now what does it take? Like, how do you get away with, like, living in both places?
It's difficult. There are
there's a rule, right? There's a threshold that says I'm really a resident here, even though I work or I'm spending.
Different
more
states have different rules.
Uh-huh. They're all different. Generally speaking, most states have a domicile test, so you want to have your driver's license, your car registrations, things like that established in the resident state, because that shows an intent to go back.
Right.
And then most of them have a catch-all, and after you've proved all that, they say, well, hold on a minute. If you've got a place of abode in both states, we don't even care anymore. We want to find out how many days did you spend
in each state,
and did you spend more than 182 days in Georgia or Florida?
So they cut it in half?
Prove it to us. Not only that, show us you ate lunch there. Show us you were.
Wow.
You know, you drove there. Prove that you were there.
Well, there's a lot of competition between states to get their pound of flesh. Mm-hmm. So,
But I saw that there's a trend that some of the states are getting rid of their state income tax. That's happening more and more often lately.
Well, the thing to remember though is they have to raise revenue
somewhere
to pay for all the goodies that we get, like airports and.
So they might raise their sales tax, or there's going to be no free ride.
And don't forget, here we actually had legislation where the amount excluded from income was projected to go higher and higher and higher, and they put a stop to in order to compete with like Florida.
Right.
But they actually put a hold on it because of what John is saying. There's just tremendous revenue issues. Mm-hmm. So you're right. There's sort of
But if you live in the things that you can't really do successfully is if you're an airline pilot, for example, and you decide you'd rather live on the beach, but you're flying out of Atlanta, you're really working out of Atlanta,
right,
then you're going to wind up paying tax on your income as a pilot because you're based out of Atlanta. If you're living in Florida, really are living in Florida, then your passive income, interest, dividends, and so on, are not subject to Georgia tax because they are taxed in the resident state. So if you have a lot of passive income, then you may still be successful in reducing your taxes overall if you live in Florida and still get taxed on your pilot salary flying out of Atlanta. Mm-hmm.
So I have two entrepreneur-related questions before we wrap today's show because, it's all about me.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
which office are you running for?
Life changes obviously have a big impact on taxes in general. What about divorce? Like if you got divorced in 2012, is there a smart way from a tax perspective to get divorced or a smart month to get divorced? Or somebody speak to divorce and its impact on taxes.
Well, if you get divorced in 2012, the one thing to remember is your filing status is based on your status the last day of the year. So if your divorce is final by the end of the year, then you would be your choices of how to file would be limited because now you're a single individual. If you have children, then if one of them is living with you, you may file as head of household, but you would no longer be married filing separately or married filing jointly. Your choice would be single or perhaps head of household. So that's one item. And if you get divorced twice in the same year, it's the last one. The last one that counts.
The last one, the end of the December is, that's where.
You may not have the problem, but there could be an issue of alimony.
Yes.
If you have significant income, I think you mentioned you didn't, but
no, it's Holly that would be paying the alimony. I assure you.
Oh, all right. Well, whichever way it goes, there are alimony issues as well, because those are taxable. So you get paid.
If I get an alimony check,
that's income, right?
Yeah, when she offers to pay you all that money, you can say, hey, wait a minute. I got to pay tax on that, sweetheart. You know. So,
and that's an above the line item.
Well, yeah. Fortunately, as far as I know, divorce is not in the cards for me and Holly. But no, I mean, entrepreneurship can be hard on a marriage. So I put that in the entrepreneur category.
I wouldn't use it as a tax planning strategy.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, the entrepreneur part, though, the one thing you still can do in 2012, if you're like a self-employed or partly self-employed, have a side job, self-employment, then you can set up a simplified employee plan.
That was my second question. You can set aside a pretty decent amount of money if you're self-employed. Yeah, talk to that a little bit.
The one caveat to that is if you have employees, you by and large have to include employees. There are some exceptions, but you should take that into account before you set one up. And it's based on your net income so that you're generally, you're deducting an amount, and you could conceivably deduct all of your net income through an
SEP. If you do it right.
If you do it right. Right.
If you're working with a professional CPA. Exactly. I mean, to me, that's the theme of this whole thing, is work with a professional CPA. This is one 45-minute conversation, and my head is spinning.
Right.
With all the differences.
We all have that problem from time to time.
But you need an accountant. You obviously need a professional accountant.
Absolutely.
I hope you got that out of this meeting.
Before we wrap up, I want to make sure we go around the room, and we'll start with you, Carly. Why don't you talk about your firm a little bit and talk about your specializations and then and the website to learn more, and then we'll go around the room and do that for everybody.
Yep. I work at Wyndham Brannan, and we're in Buckhead now, and our firm really kind of represents the Atlanta market. So we've got practices in real estate. I focus in nonprofit and service companies, high net worth individuals. If you've got basically, if you're a company in the Atlanta area that's got some complexity, you need more than just the basic forms filled out, you want somebody as a partner in your business,
right?
We can help you out.
Good stuff. And the website?
The website is www.wyndhambrannan.com.
Good stuff. John, you want to take a stab at that?
My firm name is John Masters CPA PC.
That sounds like a very smart...
Well, I'm incorporated. they took away the punch bowl 1 year, so I incorporated. But I do a lot of taxpayer representation, and people with sometimes forget to file for a few years.
They forget? That happens?
You know, it does. It does happen.
People are busy.
My view, based on my experience, is probably about one out of seven people has a tax problem. So I don't know how many of us are there in here now.
There's one of us.
Look around the room at each other.
And most of the time those occur because of, illness, divorce, a death in the family, something like that.
Right.
So, and then things back up on people. So. We do a lot of work in that area, as well as doing the regular accounting and tax returns and having a good time in other ways.
And a website?
My website is johnmasterscpa.com.
All right. Joel?
In Buckhead.
Buckhead. There you go. Joel?
I'm also in Buckhead. Firm is Berman & Associates. We're probably about 15 to 20 people and deal with a lot of individual issues, high net worth individuals, do a lot of privately held companies, S-Corps, partnership work, and the whole gamut as well, a little bit of compilation review work also, which is accounting work. Real close relationships with clients, continual, as you were talking about, continual contact throughout the year. Sometimes a lot of hand-holding, sometimes too much hand-holding. But that's basically it. Our website is www.bermanllc.com.
And to learn more about the Georgia Society of CPAs or to become a member, you can visit gscpa.org.
Good stuff. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. I think the moral of today's episode is that you need a trusted advisor. This isn't something that you should be trying to wing on your own here. Mm-hmm. And talk to your CPA early and often. Right?
Sounds wonderful. Sounds wonderful.
See y'all after April 15th.
That's right. When you guys can go and have some fun again. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Atlanta Business Radio.